appreciate you so much, but I never had to follow you as a speaker, though. But hopefully I'll still appreciate you. The title of this talk is Introducing the Possibility of Corruption to Facilitate the Reverse Engineering of Natural Systems. And I've been fortunate enough to work with several students, undergraduate engineering and theology students, who are in the honors program at Oral Roberts University, on this topic. It's really one of the most fun things I get to do, but I don't get to spend as much time on it as I'd like. We've got lots of other things that we do, and the students, who are actually research students in the honors program, get paid, even as undergraduates, to assist in this research, but they only have about 5 hours a week at the most to spend on this, so it's a kind of a small effort, but it's really a lot of fun, and I hope it's something that we can keep working on and gain some insight as we allow the fields of science and engineering and theology to kind of interact with each other to assist us in what I like this description of faith seeking understanding. We also are working with a professor of chemistry, Dr. Ken Weed, at ORU, who's helping us in the area of epigenetics, because my training is in engineering. The student that helped with this paper is Taylor Tryon, who's also a pitcher on the baseball team at ORU. So you might have heard the story about the Paris Air Show in 1947, how the Air Force, U.S. Air Force officials and government officials came to the air show, and they saw this plane fly in, and they said, "Well, look, who painted Russian markings on our B-29 Superfortress?" Turned out it was a Tu-4. Russian bomber that had been completely reverse engineered and built from captured B-29 superfortresses during the end of World War II off the Aleutian Islands there in the upper part of China, or upper part of Russia. And the Americans had a little bit of consolation when they found out that the Russians did such a good job of reverse engineering that the Russian engines caught fire due to overheating, just like the American version. So that gave them a chance to do some forensic reverse engineering. Forensic reverse engineering is simply doing what it takes, dissecting, analyzing, discovering what it is that's caused an engineered system to fail or break somehow. And we're going to apply this system, this technique, an idea perhaps to natural systems, but before we get to natural systems, let's look at an example of another more recent example. Anybody ever heard of the RQ-170 aircraft? The RQ-170 is a very recent aircraft. It's a UAV. Of course, you know what UAV stands for. Unmanned aerial vehicle, or drone. And this is used for reconnaissance. Particularly, it's been used recently in Iraq. And that is where, last December, if you saw some of the headlines, Iran's captured RQ-170. How bad is the damage? Iran to reverse engineer U.S. drone in the Telegraph in December. In April of this year, Iran hacks software of U.S. spy drone. And again in April by The Guardian, Iran claims to have reverse engineered U.S. spy drone. So that's the picture of the Sentinel UAV, RQ-170. And there's a picture of the Iranian government officials on having it on display. And a quote, I thought it was an interesting quote, from the Iranian says, "Our next action will be to reverse engineer this aircraft. In the near future, we will be able to mass produce it. Iranian engineers will soon build an aircraft superior to the American drone using reverse engineering." I don't want to offend anybody, but I'm a little bit skeptical. Let me just say that. It's quite a sophisticated aircraft. And I noticed that in the Defense News article, it said the aircraft appeared to have sustained damage consistent with a wheels-up landing. And now they did this assessment through, evidently, through just the video and photograph pictures that they were able to see from the Iranians, having not been able to get their hands on it, so they were doing this reverse engineering from a distance. This is what is known as teleepistemology, knowledge obtained from a distance. And this is not a new concept, the idea of seeing through corruption. One of the most well-known classic examples of reverse engineering is the Antikythera mechanism. Anybody heard of that? It was a mechanism that was found off the coast of Greece around the 1900. Took them about 100 years to reverse engineer, because this is what it looked like. It turned out it was a very sophisticated, incredibly sophisticated analog computer for its time, which was thought to be about 100 BC when this was built. And you can see that they had to see through an incredible amount of corruption in order to get at the final gear train, which was 27 interlocking gears, which allowed the precise prediction of the motions of planets, eclipse times, the phases of the moon. All of these things were predicted by this gear train and the motions that it brought forth. What about natural systems? Now, actually, the reverse engineering of natural systems is not my idea. You've probably seen in the news. Systems biology is a huge exploding field right now, and lots of people are claiming and agreeing that the best way to understand natural systems, living systems, is to treat them as if they were engineered systems. That's a quote from E.O. Wilson, actually. But recently, John Aweiss has written in PNAS and also a book about how the human genome could not have come about by any kind of sentient or conscious design effort, because of mainly three things: non-sentient design, footprints of non-sentient design inside the human genome. You can see the word footprints as opposed to fingerprints. So this is not anything that's consciously done. It was kind of accidentally done. Mainly three reasons he gives are seemingly wasteful elements, things like junk DNA, which don't seem to have any purpose, but they're there as a result of a non-conscious design process. Another is what looks like kind of klutzy solutions to problems that he claims. And a third is the way that, and this is a serious one that we all should be sober about, is the way that these systems malfunction regularly to cause untold pain and suffering in human beings, cancers, things like this. Well, we were thinking about this with the students and talking about it, and we thought, what about the idea of corruption? What about the possibility of corruption? Is this something that might fit in with thinking about this kind of, and responding to this kind of an assertion? We weren't the only ones that were responding. There was actually a response by Murray and Sloss in the PNAS, after the PNAS article, which I won't read all of it, but let me back up a second. Marianne Sloss responded to Aweiss in saying, because Aweiss had said, look, this kind of gets religion off the hook, because if evolution is responsible for all of this stuff, then God's not responsible. And of course, I think Sloss is a philosopher, and he said that that's not reasonable. That's just an explanatory regress. I mean, ultimately, if God is the one responsible for evolution, then he's to be responsible also for the things that are produced in this process. And so I was pleased to see that Aweiss's response to Murray and Sloss was quite accepting of this, and he made a plea right in PNAS. He says, and I'll just focus on the last part here, it's time for theologians to step up to the plate and help us to understand the philosophical implications of this marvelous but faulty genome. So I can't say that this project is partially funded by John Aweiss at UC Irvine, but I can say that this project is partially motivated by John Aweiss at UC Irvine. And also Philip Ball, who wrote this incredible article for Nature News entitled, What a Shoddy Piece of Work is Man. And I have to tell you, as an engineer, I just cannot see from his perspective. I mean, I can see the possibility of corruption because of the negatives associated with the human condition. But like the Antikythera mechanism, it had a huge amount of corruption. But one could see right away that it was an engineered system, even though heavily corrupted. I think it's the same kind of thing with the natural systems like mankind. Now, we've responded at the Christian Engineering Education Conference last summer with a paper entitled Affordance-Based Reverse Engineering of Natural Systems with Possible Corruption, where we began to respond in this to this article. And this paper today is kind of a follow-on to this work. We also looked at the idea that this moves towards, I think, towards a theodicy, because it helps to explain, using both science and theology, why we have evil and perhaps why we have evil and suffering in the world. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes here. And then also last year's ASA meeting, we addressed this idea that reverse engineering studies appear to need to burst the barriers of methodological naturalism, because you're necessarily dealing with an uncertain system, and you've got to allow all information to come to bear, not just information from field of science. You've got to allow history and metaphysical considerations, we would argue, in order to understand the nature and history of these systems. So, and also we've submitted an abstract just recently to the Baylor Conference coming up in October, Technology and Human Flourishing. And the title of that abstract is Towards a Theodicy Based on Forensic Reverse Engineering with Insight into Human Eschatology. And it's helpful that I'm just finishing up a degree at ORU in Biblical Literature, too. So I know I was giving a talk about 5 years ago in our engineering seminar class, and I don't know why, but a lot of times my talks end up getting into theological discussions at the end when students ask questions. And one of the students at the end of the question and answer session said, "Are you a theologian?" I said, "No." He said, "Why are you leading a discussion on theology? We're trying to lead a discussion on theology." I said, "Well, maybe you have a good point." That's when I started up my... I had started an MA in Biblical Literature at ORU years earlier, but I had to kind of postpone it. But after that comment, I started it back up, and it looks like I'm going to finish in May of next year. So that's helpful. So what are the kinds of questions that you ask when you're doing reverse engineering? First of all, you know, when they were looking at the Antikythera mechanism, it's like, what is it? What in the world is this? They didn't know. What does it do? How does it work? How was it put together? How did it come together? That's an interesting question that everybody's wrestling with regard to natural systems, right? What is its function or purpose? Ralph Winter mentioned the movie Hugo. Has anybody seen that movie? Mm-hmm. That's got some really good theology in it, doesn't it? I love the scene where the little boy, who's an orphan, finds this broken automaton, this broken robot, and he's trying to fix it. And he says, it always makes me sad when I see a machine that's broken, because it can't do what the original engineer intended it to do. He says, perhaps it's like that with human beings, too. If you lose your purpose, it's like you're broken. Is it possible that this artifact has been damaged or corrupted? What was the environment of its design or of its use? What are the relationships between the object you're reverse engineering, the designer, and the user? Is it possible that this damage or corruption or wear has altered what we call the affordances that this object provides? Affordances are simply what an object provides to an end user. And affordances have been brought up by Jonathan Meyer. He's been getting a lot of press lately and has written a book called Affordance-Based Design. And he claims that the concept of affordance, what a system provides to an end user, or if it's a very complex system that has multiple subsystems, multiple parts, what one part of a system provides to another part of the system in providing something to the end user. That's called a part-to-part or artifact-to-artifact affordance. He claims that affordance is an underlying and unifying principle in the science of design and reverse engineering. And this is one of the pictures that I've drawn from their article of the designer, artifact, user triad. And if anybody was in the workshop with Ted Davis on the first day, this is very similar to the triad he had of the creator. Because what you can see, you've got the designer, the artifact, that which was designed, and then the end user. And you have interesting relationships between all three of those entities. And then you have the surrounding environment, too, that you need to take into account in looking at the big picture of design. Things like law, the parent company, natural environment, manufacturer, economy. I mean, you can lay out a beautiful demonstration of this with the coconut example, you know? So affordances do a good job of capturing important interactions within this big picture of design. But we're not talking about design here. We're talking about reverse engineering. So there's a fourth entity that needs to be added to this triad, right? You know what the fourth entity is, right? Well, it's the reverse engineer. The one who is trying to understand what's going on. If the object that you're trying to reverse engineer is not clear, if its origin is not clear or if its purpose is not clear, then the investigator can be thinking about what's going on with the original engineer, what was the original user of this object. I mean, you can think of this in terms of the Antikythera mechanism. But does it make sense to apply this kind of picture with natural systems? That's what we're investigating. So let's just think about it. Help me think about this. I mean, as an example, let's look at the RQ-170. Okay, here's our template. There's the object, the drone. The engineer is, anybody know? Lockheed Martin. The user is the United States Air Force. The investigator in this case is the Iranian government. Now you can think about the interesting relationships that exist between all four of those entities. There's six relationships. Of course, Lockheed Martin has intimate knowledge of the object. They engineered it from the very beginning. And you have normal customer relationships, we hope normal customer relationships between the Air Force and Lockheed Martin. The Air Force, you know, has operational knowledge of the Sentinel, but they don't have as intimate of a knowledge.
And they have pretty good in order to purchase the...
Right. You got all those design reviews. I worked in the aerospace industry. I know what that's like. Now, what about the relationship between the investigator in this case and the original engineer? I would say that that's a silent and distant relationship. Maybe it would be a couple of words to describe that. Not a whole lot of information passing between those two entities. And of course, the adversarial relationship between Iran and the U.S. Air Force. Relationship between the artifact and, or the object of the reverse engineering and the reverse engineer would be one of curiosity and some expertise. And what about the environment? Well, this is an environment of distrust, perhaps cross purposes. I mean, Iran has made it known that they'd like to do away with Israel. Israel supposedly is our friend, so you got defensiveness, suspicion, fear, not such a great environment. But all of this plays into the reverse engineering process and knowledge about the reverse engineering process. So let's think about the next example would be living systems. And there's a lot of different ways you can go with this. You can think about the entire cosmos as the artifact or object. You can think about living systems, and let's just look at living systems, for example, as our artifact here. That's a DNA molecule strand. The engineer, everybody knows now that God is looks like Morgan Freeman in a white suit. So that's the okay. So this brings up now that my hypothesis at this point is one of a Christian kind of a God of biblical proportions, right? So in that sense, this is really like faith seeking understanding. So we're making a hypothesis of a Christian-type God, and we're going to look and see how the evidence might fit or not fit with that. Does it confirm that from science and these other fields wrapped around science? In a sense, the user of living systems is human beings. We benefit greatly from this. We see ourselves kind of as user right away, and that's the most natural kind of take we have on living systems. But isn't there another sense, if you study Christian theology at all, in which God is an end user of what he has made, isn't it? We know from Scripture that he's made all things for himself, and we're made for him. So there's kind of multiple end users here to think about. And I think it's significant, though, that with regard to purpose, that if God is the original engineer and the ultimate end user, that he gets to choose purpose. And any purpose that human beings would come up with, I think, is superseded by God in this case. So the investigator here is anybody who's curious enough to look into living systems. And I mean this in two senses. Scientists, certainly. Life scientists, biologists, all those folks, in a very real sense, in a nuts and bolts kind of sense. But I would also suggest that truth seekers, people who are sincerely seeking truth. And so let's look at the relationships here. First of all, of course, there's intimate knowledge, we believe, between the designer and the artifact or object here. Now, the thing about our relationship with God is we won't know anything unless he reveals it. That's part of the way our relationship is with God. So there's a need for revelation here, which should not surprise us then that there might be a special revelation in addition to the natural general revelation. And of course, we have operational knowledge of our own living systems that we have. What about the investigator with regard to the original engineer? Again, we see there, in a sense, it's silent and distant, but is there potential for a spiritual relationship? As Christians, we believe so. In order to become an investigator and not just a user, doesn't it require humility? An admission that you don't have all the answers, that you'd like to know truth about what these systems imply and how they work. And they produce wonder, don't they? 5 minutes? They produce wonder. The investigator certainly has to have curiosity, but we see an appreciation that develops when people really study life and life processes. The environment then is limited knowledge of reality as humans, but also a sense of brokenness that we know about the human condition, all the negatives associated with the human condition. And from a Christian perspective, don't forget also an adversarial influence, the presence of an adversary who'd like to throw a wrench into the works. You know, and apparently, who has thrown a wrench into the works from the very beginning and perhaps has caused a significant amount of corruption to be produced. Now, one of the things that Joe Marchant talks about in Decoding the Heavens, which is the story of the Antikythera mechanism, the reverse engineering of the Antikythera mechanism, she says, we need to look at things from the point of view of the ancient craftsman that we're trying to second guess. And this is what one of the researchers of the Antikythera mechanism did. What could brokenness perhaps afford in the human condition? Well, according to Richard Swinburne, Oxford philosopher of religion, it provides us with significant opportunities to show compassion and kindness, to grow useful and strong, to learn truth. Augustine said, God thought it good to draw good out of evil rather than that no evil would exist at all. And Psalm 119 says, it was good for me to be afflicted so that I might learn your decrees. And then he compares it here to riches. The law from your mouth is more precious to me than thousands of pieces of silver and gold. I'm going to skip over these, but this basically is an affordance structure matrix where the elements of a system are listed across the top in for the columns, and then the resulting affordances are listed along this axis. And if certain parts of the system are have play a role in providing these affordances, then you put a check mark in the box, and you can do this for any engineered system. I was trying to do it, and the students were trying to do it for the mind-body system, which Richard Swinburne elegantly describes, that results in these affordances, you know, things like the ability to reason and form beliefs and the ability to have free will, but then to produce actions in order to accomplish purposes. They could be either positive or negative, depending on what we choose, and that these produce change, not only in the world, but end up causing change in ourselves. And this is significant. These affordances are significant indicators of meaning and purpose in life, I believe. And the biology or chemistry professor who's helping us with this was helping us think about the kinds of change that can be produced through epigenetics, through just lifestyle choices and environment. It's not all told by the DNA. So very quickly, changes to cytosine residues, which can bind to methyl groups within DNA, alter genetic expression without altering DNA sequences. The amount of methylation in these site changes in response to environmental conditions. So environmental conditions alter the functionality of identical structures. So while many genetic factors exist in rheumatoid arthritis, if one twin develops the disease, the other twin only has a 15% chance of also getting the disease in spite of being genetically identical. In other words, environmental factors play a significant role in the development of our and maturation of our bodies and who we become. I'm going to skip through some more of this. Finally, he concludes, hopes of genetic miracles following the reading of the genome have transformed into an understanding that environment or choice has such deep consequences that restoration must await further revelation. So we're going to continue to learn about epigenetics and how it affects human beings. As Eden Philpott said, the universe is full of magical things patiently waiting for our wits to grow sharper. And this reminds me of Arthur C. Clarke's third law. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But it also caused us to think about a corollary to Arthur C. Clarke's third law that I think helps with theodicy. And that is, any sufficiently advanced technology may also be confused with malevolence. Is this a picture of a surgery or a murder? You don't know because you don't have full information. Isn't it the same way with the human condition? We don't have full information. So in a lot of things that may seem negative perhaps could turn out to be positive. There's another book that just recently came out that talked about the importance of images in producing understanding. And when I was teaching a philosophy of mathematics course the last couple of years, we chose a book by James Robert Brown, Philosophy of Mathematics, a contemporary introduction into the world of proofs and pictures. And he emphasizes picture proofs for in mathematics in here. And he says some pictures are not really pictures, but rather are windows into Plato's heaven of non-material truths and abstract entities and abstract truths. Like, you may have seen some of these picture proofs. Here's one with a sequence of images that demonstrate Pythagorean's theorem. How could you prove? Would you like to prove the summation from n equals 1 to infinity of 1 to the 4th, or 1 over 4 to the nth power is equal to 1/3? Could you prove that? Only rigorous mathematicians can do that, but it's a very simple and elegant picture proof. 1/4 of the area, 1/16 of the area, etc., etc., is obviously 1/3 of the whole. Isn't it? There's others too. But here's an example from Wittgenstein. While a point A describes a circle, B describes a figure 8. Now we write this down as a proposition of kinematics. We can say that proof must show the existence of an internal relation. The picture proof is an instrument producing conviction. Do you see the relationship here? this goes around in a circle. Therefore, point B, if point A goes around in a circle, point B goes through a figure eight, right? That's obvious, isn't it? There's only one problem. It's mistaken. It's misdrawn. If this point A is at the top of the wheel here, then this point B should not be at that place, should it? It should be about right here. But Brown makes a huge point of this in his book, Philosophy of Mathematics. He says, the picture, flawed though it is simply an aid to the understanding. It triggers the grasping of the sense. Thus, as a picture, it need not be accurate. It need only lead to the sense. The Platonic entity is perhaps the universe like this. Although flawed, it still leads us to an accurate image. That's just an example of something bad that happened, which produced good for many people. The origin of RK surgery actually was said to be from a child who fell off his bike and his glasses broke and cut his eye, and his vision was better afterwards. I'll just close with this. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, having been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. That's it.